The markets take in good news on the job front.
And bad news from the Fed.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, April 4th.
Coming up, the Fed did not have anything to do with the Watergate burglary, in case you were wondering.
Groupon faces a lawsuit for allegedly falsifying financial reports.
And James Bond goes down market.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Yahoo said this morning it is cutting 2,000 jobs in a major shakeup of the 17-year-old company, which is struggling to compete with Google and Facebook. Meanwhile, the payroll processing company ADP said the U.S. private sector added 209,000 jobs last month. And that's where we'll start now with Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, who's with us from New York. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going, Jeremy?
Going well. So Yahoo is cutting, but overall looks like the private sector is adding jobs. We're, of course, waiting for Friday's big employment report from the government. How do you square this with the high gas prices and everything else that's going on?
So apparently high gas prices have not yet impacted hiring, which is good. This is the fourth ADP report in a row with more than 200,000 jobs created in the private sector. So it's not a, you know, it's hard to find a negative here. I think what's most interesting is if you look at the breakdown, large companies with more than 500 employees only added 22,000 jobs. The bulk of this 209,000 total number came from small businesses who added 100,000 new workers.
And Josh, let me ask you about something else that's obviously driving the markets this morning. The Fed, we learned yesterday, is probably not going to do any more quantitative easing, this big bond-buying stimulus they've been up to. What does that mean for the economy?
You know, it's hard to draw a direct link between quantitative easing and the economy. It's much easier to draw a link between quantitative easing programs and the stock market. And really, if you look at the history of the market over the last 3 years, it throws a temper tantrum. We get a big sell-off, and then all of a sudden, the Fed is back with its latest program. So I think we should look at it somewhat as an announcement of confidence that they're basically saying we can take our foot off the gas because employment trends are improving. It remains to be seen whether or not they'll still be able to say the same thing in 3 months.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Surf's down at Procter & Gamble. The consumer goods giant has started limiting which websites its workers can visit. P&G is now blocking Pandora and Netflix on company computers. I don't know, Jeremy, how do you think that would go over at Marketplace?
I don't know. I don't do a lot of Pandora and Netflixing while I'm in the office, but that's just me.
Yeah, that is some hardcore procrastinating right there. The company said those sites have been sucking up bandwidth needed for business, and Sarah Gardner has that story.
P&G discovered employees were hogging a quarter of the company's bandwidth for videos, music, photos, all from social media and entertainment sites. But it ended up banning just two, Pandora and Netflix. P&G's Paul Fox says that's because they weren't business critical.
Things like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are parts of our business, and we use them all the time for brand building and talking to our consumers.
It's true, even Pampers has its own Facebook page. P&G isn't the first company to block websites, of course. Many still ban Facebook, but Rebecca Wedeman at Nucleus Research says she sees that less and less.
And what we're seeing is more companies having a more flexible policy and understanding the distinction between different sites and different job roles.
In other words, the marketing department gets Facebook and Twitter, accounting doesn't. Still, unless you're a movie critic, you may have a hard time justifying Netflix. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The Daily Deals website Groupon is being sued by a shareholder who says the company misled investors about its finances. Last week, Groupon revised its fourth quarter earnings, saying it failed to set aside enough money for customer refunds. The Securities and Exchange Commission is now reportedly investigating that change. Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe is with us now for more on this. Hi, John.
Good morning.
So what's going on here with Groupon?
Well, the plaintiff charges that Groupon's growth and revenue were overstated, that it's not as resistant to competition as it had made itself out to be, that it issued false and misleading results, and the internal controls were so lousy that it made reporting its own results pretty unreliable. Essentially, he's saying that Groupon is a lemon of a car with a new paint job slapped on it.
Hmm. And Groupon has been a real success story in the world of tech. Does something like this matter to Groupon? Is the company as concerned with its shareholders as it is with, say, its customers?
Whether it's shareholders or customers, Groupon really relies on trust. And it's obviously a different business model. So to get people to come on board for something like that, those customers or those investors need to know that the transaction is secure, the deals are honest, that everything is on the up and up. And if that's not the case, and if Groupon loses that confidence, bigger companies are perfectly willing to come in and take over in that coupon space that Groupon has been establishing for so long. Google wants to get in there, and Facebook and a bunch of other companies would love to be in that space.
And many already are. John Moe of Marketplace Tech Report, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
What do Google, The Gap, and Starbucks have in common? They're all participating in a new job creation program that relies on your purchases. Marketplace's Eve Tro has that story.
Starbucks has never been about just making money, says VP of Communications Jim Olson. It's about
nurturing and inspiring humanity.
Frustrated at Washington gridlock, CEO Howard Schultz started the Create Jobs for USA Fund last year. Starbucks Foundation gave $5 million to make loans in low-income neighborhoods, everything from charter schools to a gelato shop.
It's the smaller businesses and community organizations that are having the door shut on them.
Mostly by big banks, Olson says. Customers have donated $2.5 million to the cause, buying Jobs wristbands alongside their lattes. Now, divisions of Google and The Gap will chip in sales revenue that could add millions more. Olson says the fund could create or save about 4,000 jobs.
Kind of a small drop in the bucket,
says UCLA economist Jerry Nicholsberg.
It's not a national job strategy. It's Starbucks pursuing its own self-interest.
As companies should do, he says. Just don't mistake good marketing for a jobs miracle. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective on Business and Economics. A top Chinese official called for the country to crack down on its bank monopoly. Small businesses have had trouble getting loans, and that's putting a damper on China's growth. The BBC's Martin Patience joins us now from Beijing to explain. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Tell us, Martin, what exactly is China proposing to do with the banks?
Well, I think what Premier Wen Jiabao wants to see is these banks offering greater loans to smaller private businesses. Now, until now, we've seen these major banks, they tend to favour loaning to state-run enterprises, and often smaller businesses have been starved of capital. Why does that happen? Well, often these state-owned enterprises, as the name would suggest, are backed by the government, so therefore the banks almost have no risk of default on these debts.
Is it an unusual thing for a communist country to be breaking up a banking monopoly? It struck me as strange when I read the story.
Well, I think what you have to understand about China, it still does have a communist party, but certainly when it comes to its economy, it is run along market lines. But what the authorities here want to see going into the future is small enterprises, small and medium enterprises playing a bigger role in China's economy. They believe that these enterprises, these small firms, will be able to drive profits and growth, and most importantly, create jobs in China, because they fear that if there is a downturn in the economy, then high unemployment could lead to serious social unrest.
Why are the Chinese so concerned about bank behavior right now?
Well, what we've seen in terms of small and medium-sized businesses is that they've been going to underground lenders, so-called informal lenders, and they pay a higher interest rate on loans than they do compared to their official rates. And what the authorities worry about is that we could see an explosion of bad debt when it comes to small and medium-sized businesses.
What happens now?
what we're seeing from Premier Wen Jiabao is a greater push for economic reform. What he wants to see is the states having a lesser say in how the economy is run and private entrepreneurs and private businesses having a bigger say, because they believe in the future that is what is going to drive growth in China. When it comes to technology, innovation, then that is going to be the business of these small firms.
The BBC's Martin Patience from Beijing. Martin, thank you.
No bother.
Next week, the U.S. and five other world powers are scheduled to meet with Iranian officials about Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. is pushing other countries to impose tough sanctions to get Iran to curb its nuclear ambitions. But India is reluctant to go along, as Christopher Wirth reports now from New Delhi.
Iranian crude currently accounts for about 12% of India's oil imports, and India has stepped up its purchases since January, according to a report from the International Energy Agency. China and Japan are the only countries that buy more. But Tarun Lakhotia, an analyst at Kotak Securities in Mumbai, says there's plenty of oil to be had from other producers.
They can increase oil imports from countries like Saudi Arabia, where there is a reasonable amount of spare capacity.
But so far, the Indian government isn't budging. Finance Minister Pranab Mukherjee says India abides by UN sanctions, but it's not obliged to follow those imposed unilaterally by the US or Europe. Lydia Powell is with the Observer Research Institute in New Delhi.
India would like to be seen as a country which makes its own decisions. It wants to be seen as a strong, independent country.
And it's a fast-growing economy that needs all the energy it can get to maintain its current growth levels and satisfy the fuel hunger of its rising middle class. Powell says even if India wanted to wean itself off Iranian oil, that wouldn't be easy. Many of India's refineries are old and built specifically for processing Iranian crude. Plus, she says, Iran sells its oil to India at a discount.
The discounts which these refineries are used to, even if they are just a couple of dollars, it makes a big difference in their profitability.
But under U.S. sanctions, any country that doesn't make a significant reduction in Iranian oil imports by June could face sanctions itself. And Indian banks processing oil payments with Iran could be barred from the U.S. banking system. I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And Christopher reports with support from the International Reporting Project in Washington, D.C.
Syria says it started to withdraw troops from some cities as part of an international ceasefire plan, though reports this morning indicate Syrian troops are not pulling back. Meanwhile, the country's economy is moving back in time. In 2005, import bans were lifted and foreign chains like The Gap and KFC started pouring in. Now they're pulling out. Katie Paul is a journalist based in Beirut. She's written about this issue for Foreign Policy magazine. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
Katie, you wrote an article that appeared in Foreign Policy about how businesses are faring in Syria, particularly foreign chains like KFC and the United Colors of Benetton. What did you find?
Well, I found that all of these stores had moved in the last few years as the government was pursuing a liberalization policy. In the last decade since Bashar al-Assad took power, they'd been liberalizing the trade laws and so letting imports come in. So you saw places like KFC and Cinnabon, you saw all of these things come in. But then as the situation has devolved in Syria during the uprising, they've been running into more and more problems just getting their products to Syria, transporting them around Syria, and finding people who are willing to spend money on clothes and kind of frivolous things at a time when they're struggling with increasing power cuts and many people are losing their jobs.
What are the long-term implications for expansion of foreign chains into Syria?
Like most things in Syria, I think it's safe to be somewhat pessimistic at this point. A lot of the chains have cut down on their expansion plans, if not pulled out altogether. So, for example, Benetton, which is like one of the most established companies in Syria because it's been operating there for so long, they've been planning to open 25 stores within the next few years, and they've knocked that down to about two or three stores. KFC had also been planning to expand, and they've actually closed stores. So they still have one restaurant up in Aleppo and a few in Damascus, and that's because they can source their chicken locally.
Well, Katie, what are the implications of this for Syria? I mean, is it such a bad thing if foreign chains close?
No, no, not necessarily. The people who really benefited from these chains coming in were the privileged elite that had connections to the regime. So they were the ones who got the contracts locally for them. And so you saw a large portion of the population becoming less wealthy and more marginalized, and then a very tiny sliver actually benefiting from the wealth that was coming in. But it is a sign of the times, and it's being perceived as such. So in that sense, it is sad to see happen.
Katie Paul is a reporter based in Beirut. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
A new report has discovered a bit of information that might apply to your work life or your employers. According to the research, intelligent people are less likely to take sick leave from work.
Here to talk with us about the findings in today's Midday Extra is Matthew Hotop, professor of psychiatry at King's College in London. He co-authored the study. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how did you come up with these findings?
Well, we used data from three very large population studies which have been running in the UK for many years. These are birth cohorts which follow people all the way from the time when they were born, in one case in 1946, through their life. And what we did was we looked at people who had reached a stage in their adult life when they were unable to work because of ill health. So they were receiving some kind of benefits from the state because of long-term illness, which was affecting their ability to work.
What is the connection here between intelligence and sickness? Is it that intelligent people seem less likely to get sick, or they're just less likely to take a day off work when they do get sick?
Well, I think it's complex, but there is certainly a lot of evidence suggesting that people with higher intelligence tend to get ill less. They tend to live longer. They have better mental health. They are better adapted, in a sense. They're better adapted to their environment. And therefore, they tend to do better in terms of overall health. They tend to smoke less, drink less, and so on. So there's all sorts of reasons why they may have less sickness absence. But one of the things I think we are sort of suggesting is that that doesn't explain it all. And the reason it doesn't explain it all is when you control for all those variables, those other explanations, the effect's still there. And we think that's probably because intelligent people are better adapted to the workplace. So if you think about it, in the UK, we've gone from a manufacturing economy with, you know, a lot of routine work to a service economy where people are shifting jobs much, much more. And the people who are more intelligent, even if they have an illness, are better adapted to being able to keep in the workplace.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that in my experience here, the people who are most often sick tend to be the people who have children. And I always think, you know, that the kids are bringing home all kinds of sicknesses from school. That seems like it's a bigger factor to me than whether they're intelligent, although maybe they're just not intelligent.
Well, I think we have to distinguish it. What this report is about is people who are long-term sick. So these are people who have left the workplace. They don't have a job. They're receiving state benefits because they are supposedly unable to work because of ill health. So it's certainly the case. I mean, you know, I've got kids of my own, and you know, when they start going to school, they bring home every germ that's going, and the parents suffer as well, and you suffer as well because you're up all night looking after them, and you feel absolutely awful. But that might cause an increase in short-term, you know, missing a couple of days here and there, but it doesn't cause people to be off work for months and months or even years.
What kind of implications could this study have for the workplace?
Well, we think it's about saying that the process by which people go from a situation where they're in work to being unable to work because of long-term health problems is that it's a process. It's not simply, you know, the number of people who have disabilities who actually manage to work is very high. There are lots of people who are able to work despite disabilities. So it's a bit more subtle than just, you know, you either can or you can't work because of your health. And we think that in a sense, the response to people long-term off sick is probably, you know, what governments need to think of is probably more around training and the capacity for people to be integrated into the workplace is more around that than necessarily just straight health. In the UK, we have a benefit system which people start getting paid if they've got a disability which is unlikely to recover for them to get back to work. But if you wanted to get people off that, the response might be best aimed at training as well as getting their health optimized.
Matthew Hotop is professor of psychiatry at King's College in London. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Jeremy, are you an Angry Birds fan?
I used to be. I was an early adopter, and then I kind of I got a message on my screen that said something like, "You've played for 5 million hours," and I freaked out and I stopped playing.
Well, I have good news for you, which is that you can have some free Angry Birds.
Oh, okay.
Again, Angry Birds is going to be made into a cartoon later this year. It's sort of maybe a cartoonette is more accurate. The show's episodes will only be 3 minutes long. They will have no dialogue, and apparently they pretty much entirely consist of Angry Birds being catapulted into space.
Wow, that is really going to be a hit.
I know. Well, no. Apparently they're so excited about the idea, there's a movie deal, too.
Oh, great. Is that going to be 3 minutes with no dialogue as well?
I don't know. Silent movies are back, maybe. I don't know. Today, President Obama will sign the Stock Act. That's the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. It says Capitol Hill has to play by the same insider trading rules as other industries do. From Washington, Elizabeth Wynn Johnson has more.
Members of Congress have unique insight into changing laws, regulations, and who stands to win or lose. Until now, these privileged players have been exempt from insider trading laws that would prevent them from using that information to score unfair profits in the stock market. John Wunderlich says the Stock Act changes that. He's with the Sunlight Foundation, which advocates for government transparency.
They're always going to be able to abuse the rules a little bit. But the least we can do is make it clear that certain kinds of behavior aren't acceptable or certain things are illegal.
What the Stock Act doesn't do is impose any such rules on so-called political intelligence operatives. That's Beltway speak for individuals and firms who collect information on Capitol Hill in order to sell it to investors.
These are people that use their access to information to make a profit and to benefit people who are looking to find out what's going to happen and often trade on that information.
Accountability experts say the political intelligence industry is overdue for some transparency, but they won't get it from the Stock Act. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
All right, now back to something we talked about at the top of the program with Josh Brown. It's the fact that the Fed isn't all that interested in stimulus right now. Well, that may perk up the ears of economists and analysts like Josh, but right now we're going to talk about another news item from the Fed that would probably stimulate interest for a mystery writer. Marketplace's David Gura is with us from Washington to explain. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So this item, I gather, comes from the Fed's Inspector General.
That's right. So we're learning about the Fed's history. First, we learned the Federal Reserve was not involved in the Watergate burglary back in 1972. The cash used in the scandal did not come through the Federal Reserve. And second, there's no evidence that the Fed helped Saddam Hussein, helped Iraq get billions of dollars to buy weapons in the 80s.
Okay, all good to know. But why was the Inspector General looking into this?
Okay, so back in February of 2010, Ben Bernanke was testifying before the House Financial Services Committee, and Republican Congressman Ron Paul, one of the Fed's biggest critics, made these two claims about the Fed and Watergate and about the Fed supposedly loaning money to Saddam Hussein. And this was Ben Bernanke's reply at the hearing back then.
Congressman, these specific allegations you've made, I think, are absolutely bizarre, and I have absolutely no knowledge of anything remotely like what you just described.
So at that hearing, the Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, who was at that point the chair of the committee, asked for an investigation. The Inspector General pores over documents and ultimately concludes in this report, Jeremy, there's no evidence of undue political interference with Federal Reserve officials in either of these cases. It's just not true.
Ben Bernanke probably breathing a sigh of relief this morning. Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, to Bond, James Bond. Now, we all know what he likes to drink.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
A martini, Stacey, shaken, not stirred.
Yes,
well, maybe
yes.
Not anymore. According to Advertising Age, James Bond will be tossing back a Heineken in his next movie.
Oh.
Apparently, Heineken has had a big contract with James Bond or a partnership over the last 15 years or so, but it's never involved Bond actually drinking beer in the movies. But this time it will. And we just hope that he doesn't shake that Heineken up before he drinks it, because that would probably not be a good situation.
I don't know. James Bond is a beer man? What do you think about that?
They say it makes him a man of the world, I guess, because Heineken is Dutch, but
Well, he is the most interesting man in the world, although that's the wrong beer, but...
Maybe they're trying to make it more of an upscale beer. We'll have to see. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.